one thing, and then the same order of row, you get, well, you can maybe see in the picture better than with my arms, but you get something that's not trivial, right? Where you go around, the two strands are twisted around each other. Whereas if you do R and then R inverse, obviously, you're doing something that looks more like this, which is trivial, you can see, right? One is just behind the other. So, so what we want here is something that's trivial, right? Because if we went all the way around and did a non-trivial braid, then we wouldn't expect to get the identity. So to get the identity, we want to do a trivial braid. So how does that arise? So I wish I had erased a different board now, but in the middle of the hexagon? Well, I want to make it bigger so you can see. So the point is, what we're going to do is first we braid A with B and C. Okay, so we have three strands here, A, B, and C. And we put A in front, B and C move to the left like this. Okay? And then we want to switch A and C down at the bottom. So that's the last two things. And so what we'd really like to do is just move A back out on top, right? Like the R inverse picture. So to do that, we have to do R inverse down here, because R would put the left-hand one on top. So if we want to put A on top like this, so this here is R, this here is R inverse. Okay, and then to do the third one, we have to switch A and B. And again, we have to do R inverse for the same reason. Okay, and you can look at this and see that the A strand is on top, so we can push it over to the left and get, we should get the identity. And then the F's are just fusing these and unfusing these in different ways. Yeah?
We apply two R's and
to the same pair of strands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We come back to the same position that we had.
Yes, but we don't do, but we do a non-trivial operation, right? Because so this is R, the left one goes on top. And then we do R again, the left one goes on top. We've gotten this. Okay, and you look at this, you see they're twisted. So it's a non-trivial braid. We don't expect it to be identity. And so you get back to the same Hilbert space, but you've done some non-trivial operation. Okay? Okay. Okay, so for the Fibonacci model, what do we have? So remember, we have only one way to fuse three ones into a zero, right? So this F matrix is not very interesting. It's just a number, which I guess we can set to be equal to 1. So the interesting one is this one, which is a two-dimensional one. 1, 1, 1 fuse into 1. So this is a two-dimensional matrix. Because remember, this internal thing could be either 0 or 1. And they don't have to be the same in these two cases, of course. And what's more, you can get a superposition up here, remember. So in this case, the F matrix, turns out, is this. And here, tau is root 5 minus 1 over 2. Okay? I think that's not unitary, so there's an issue of scaling here. But that actually doesn't really matter very much, because we're kind of going from one Hilbert space to a different Hilbert space, so we don't necessarily expect them to be comparable. It's only when we're going from one Hilbert space to itself that we have to be careful.
But you applied this matrix on the web.
Sorry?
I kind of confused. So that matrix, you apply it like on what? Like it's
on what? On the basis states. So if you take a basis state here, then you're going to get. Like, so if you take, for instance, the 1, 1, the case we have a 0 here. Okay. So if you apply, so that gives you the first row here. You get tau times the 0 here plus root tau times the 1 here. Okay. So the F matrix is by itself not something we use, because again, it takes us from one representation to another representation. So we're always going to go back to the standard one with the trees written like this. And so it's the B matrix that we're going to be interested in. Remember, the definition of the B matrix involves these Fs. So we need to also know what the R is. So there's two. Two R cases, one where we switch these, and one where we have this merger and we switch these. And so in each one, it's just one dimensional Hilbert space. So we just get some number, which are complex numbers, but they're different complex numbers. So in this case, we get e to the r equals e to the 4 pi I over 5. In this case, we get e to the minus 2 pi I over 5. Okay, and so then taking these equations, modulo this issue about where the inverses were in the definition of B, then you can say what happens if you have a more complicated system, right? So in particular, I guess we're interested in that drawing. So we're interested in this case, which represents a qubit, right? We have four anions with a one charge. They merge to form a zero total charge. It has a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And so this is our qubit. And so we can do one qubit operations by braiding these anions around each other. So what happens if we braid the first two? Well, that does the, let's see. So the what are the two qubits here? The two qubits are either 0, 1, right? So if these two merge to get a 0, then this one has to merge to get a 1. Or 1, if these two merge to get a 1, then these two, they can't merge to get a 0, because then we get a 1 out here. So they have to merge to get a 1. So those are the two qubit states, 0, 1, and 1, 1. So braiding the first two is giving us one phase if we have the 0, 1 case, and the other phase if we have the 1, 1 case, right? So we get these two R matrices. So braid first two, we get the sigma 1, the first generator of the braid group, is this 2 by 2 matrix. e to the 4 pi I over 5, e to the minus 2 pi I over 5, and then zeros. Okay? Yeah?
We factor the global plane to make this somewhat pretty.
Well, you can factor out a little bit if you want, but it won't really make it any prettier. I don't think. Right. Well, I mean, okay, it's a matter of taste. You get a 6 pi I over 5. So then sigma 2, well, sigma 2 is one of those B matrices, which I'm not going to multiply out. So it's going to be the B for these two. Which you can find using the formulas I said. So it's the appropriate F, R, F inverse. Okay. But again, yeah, and you have to be careful with these labels, get everything right, and multiply them together. And this will give you the second generator grade group. And similarly, the third generator is going to be that one. Okay? And because this F is off diagonal, these things will turn out not to commute with each other. So it's a non-abelian representation of the grade group. We have non-abelian anions after all. And it turns out that these will generate a group which is dense in SU2. Well, SU2. Oh, okay. So up to the global phase issue, SU2, let's say. Obviously, this is not an SU2, so. But okay. The point is that using these, you can get arbitrarily close to any single qubit operation. Okay. So that's good. So that gives you single qubit gates. Obviously, to go further, you need two qubit gates. So for, yeah?
Can you remind me what's an SU2 or not an SU2 that is in U2?
Oh, it's, I guess, a matter of overall phase. So SU2 is determinant 1. Which you can just take out. So unitaries have, after all, you know, if you diagonalize them, it's just e to the I phi as eigenvalues. So the determinant is going to be some complex phase. If you take that complex phase out, you can make it determinant 1. So the difference between SU2 and U2 is just, again, it's focal phase. So anyway, for two qubit gates, well, so now we have not four particles, but eight particles. And, well, if we braid things within each set of four, well, clearly we won't get any two qubit gates that way, right? We'll just get SU2. Cross SU2. Not enough to be interesting. So how do we get, say, a control NOT gate? Well, it's hard to say. I don't know that there's any braid that gets exactly a control NOT gate. In fact, I don't think in this case there is. But it turns out that if you look at the appropriate set of braid group generators, so there's one in particular, if you have this picture with eight of these anions, there's going to be one that's going to map going to exchange the fourth one with the fifth one. Right? So that's going to do something that kind of interacts with two qubits. Except the problem is it takes us out of this four-dimensional Hilbert space of the two qubits. And it turns out that the braid group on eight anions generate a dense subset of SU13, which you see is the full Hilbert space is eight-dimensional particles. So you can do an arbitrary, or you can do arbitrarily close to an arbitrary unitary on this 13-dimensional Hilbert space. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of a little related to that. Let's say, so if you want to have one qubit, you go, you know, you take four anions.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to, well, here I guess two qubits is not good, but let's say three qubits, could you go to seven? Like, you take the seven ones that fuse into a zero.
Well,
no.
So in principle, you could do that if you want to just say, well, forget about one qubit. I want to embed three qubits and seven anions. The problem is that when you take 14 anions, you're going to, again, have extra dimensions of the Hilbert space. And again, what we'd like to be able to do is to say, we're going to take a regular quantum algorithm built out of controlled Mach gates and Hadamard gates and Poincaré gates and whatever, and write it in terms of a set of grid, well, of a big grid that everyone is. So in order to do that, we want to kind of identify where our qubits are as discrete things and be able to apply that systematically. Whereas if you think of what you're doing in the asymptotic limit, if you have lots and lots of qubits, well, it's hard to say exactly how you're going to do the mapping, embedded the qubit space into this bigger space.
Because it does seem that you get sort of less than linear growth in the number of anions. That's the number of qubit, kind of.
Well, it's linear. It's just that the constant is log of phi. So if you have these eight anions and you do some arbitrary gradient, you get a dense subgroup of SU13. But the problem is only a dense subgroup. Okay? So in particular, you don't necessarily get any grid that's exactly equal to the control Mach gate on your two qubits or any other interesting two qubit gate. It's possible there's some two qubit gate that you get exactly. I don't know. I don't think anybody knows actually to answer that question. But certainly, for the specific ones we're interested in, no such grid is known. So what does that mean? That means that when you do this grid, well, you can get as close as you want to two qubit operations. There's always going to be some amplitude that takes you outside of the Hilbert space you'd like to work in. Okay, so that seems like a problem. There's two solutions to it, both of which you should be able to figure out. Does anyone want to suggest one?
Error correction.
Okay, so how is that going to work? You have no idea. You've taken this whole class on error correction. You have no idea.
Well, the Tori code. I don't know.
Well, okay. So look. What's the problem here? The problem is that we do this grading, and when we do it, we might get outside of the qubit Hilbert space. So this is something we discussed when we talked about fault tolerance, right? This is a leaky error. And in principle, if you really had the ability to measure charges, you could tell that you had leaked outside, because the qubit Hilbert space should have charge zero for the first four particles and charge zero also for the second four particles. So if you measure both of those charges, you can, and you get one of them as non-zero, then you can see by doing this grade you've leaked out. Okay? And then you could throw it away and replace it with a new set of four that was in the right charge, and then it's an error, it's a located error. You do error correction, and using regular thresholds here, for instance, once you've gotten a grid that's close enough to the Hilbert space, this leakage is rare at whatever level you want to set, and therefore you're okay. Right? You can do arbitrary long computations that way.
So you can't really correct those grid errors, but you just have zero in
them. Well, so this is one possible solution. I mean, you're correcting them in the sense that the whole thing is encoded in error correcting code, and so then losing this one encoded qubit is not so bad. So that's one solution. What's the other solution? So this one I forgive you for not getting, because we only discussed it very briefly.
Use qubits instead of qubits? And you also don't use a full 13.
Well, no, that of course is not going to solve the problem. Because then if you go to, again, same problem. So then if you take two of these, again, the Hilbert space is going to be even larger, so you're going to have the same difficulty. But remember, we do have a, something that gets us a dense set in SU13, right? So we have basically we have a set of gates that's universal for SU13, right? And we have this Kataev-Solovay theorem, which said that you have this universal set of gates that can get arbitrarily close to any gate in some unitary group. Then you can get to accuracy epsilon using only some poly log epsilon, poly log 1 over epsilon gates. Okay? So that's what we can do here. Well, since we are dense, we can get arbitrarily close. And so we can make the error rate as low as we like. So for instance, if we have t gates in our whole computation, we make the error rate less than 1 over t. Okay? And to do that requires only some poly log t of these original braids, braid generators.
How's that different from the first solution?
Well, the scaling is similar. I mean, they're both poly log overhead. But it's a different solution. I mean,
no, but what I'm saying is, right, so the error, so using our corrections, because you know, you had a dense group, but when you say you have a dense group, you have it up to arbitrarily close.
Right. So the error correction says, well, you do some kind of braid that gets accuracy up to a certain amount.
Yeah.
And once we're below this constant threshold value, then we apply error correction to get the rest of the way. Whereas the Kataev-Solovay theorem says go directly to get a very small
more brute force approach.
Yeah, a little more. Well, it can be, yes. They both involve a lot of brute forceness, I guess. It's just what you apply to. So error correction involves adding extra qubits, extra anions. In this case, it involves doing lots of extra gates. So it's kind of space versus time trade-off.
Is it obvious that the same scaling if the braids themselves can be a little erroneous?
Depends what your measure of being wrong is for the braid. So remember, we're thinking of this as a fault-tolerant computation itself. We're keeping all these particles far apart and moving them around each other to the braid. But when we do that, we're also keeping them far apart. So if you know we have a little bit of wiggling in the path, that doesn't matter. It does the same braid. Unless the wiggling is so much that it changes the actual topology. So it doesn't go around instead of going around. But the idea is that that could be exponentially unlikely with the distance between the particles. So that part of the scaling probably is not coming into it. The scaling is not the same. I mean, they're both polynomials and logarithm of the accuracy you want, but they're different polynomials. I think it would be surprising if they would have to be the same. Any other questions? So anyway, that's how we do these anionic quantum computations. We take a bunch of anions, we put them together into a large enough Hilbert space to have a two-dimensional Hilbert, a large enough system to have a two-dimensional Hilbert space. That's our qubit. We imagine taking groups of these anions of, in this case, blocks of four, to get many qubits, and we braid them all around each other. We get some unitary in this bigger Hilbert space, which we then restrict to the ones that are close to the tensor product space that we're interested in. Yeah?
How many groups are working on this experiment with approximately?
Experimentally. So I don't think anybody is anywhere near trying to implement actual universal computation. I don't know, there may be. There's a handful of groups working on trying just to demonstrate that non-abelian anions exist using some kind of interference experiment. So they want to do one braid or something like that. I don't know. Maybe I would guess three or four, but I'm not sure. And then there may be other groups that, like I said, are interested in trying to implement in other kinds of quantum computing systems, superconductors, optical lattices, whatever. Complicated Hamiltonians that might have anionic excitations, but as far as I know, that's not very far advanced either. Yeah.
How are we doing things like state preparation and measurements?
Well, okay, so state preparation, kind of the only thing we have available to us is to create particles out of the vacuum. I mean, and this is at a hand-wavy level. I mean, obviously, what we actually have available to us is dependent on the anion model itself. So what we can do is we can flip these diagrams around and do a split, one of these splitting rules. Takes a vacuum and produces particles. And it can produce one particles or not. And then what we can do, so the assumption, I guess I mentioned at the end of last time, but not today, is the assumption that we have the ability to do that, to create particles out of the vacuum. Charge, anti-charge pairs, basically. And then we have the ability to measure charges. Okay, so what we can do is we can take two particles and cram them together and see if they fuse into a zero. Okay? So that's going to be our measurement, is this charge measuring procedure. So what we can do is, so we can do more complicated measurement by taking some particles, taking one set of particles, moving them around another set of particles, and then measuring this set of particles. Okay, so we can create some out of vacuum, move them around, and try to compress them into a vacuum again. And so that gives us some kind of charge measurement of this other system that we moved around, right? Because what happens here depends on the state here, and whether or not we can get a vacuum state here then will therefore depend on what happened here. So for instance, if this has a total charge zero, moving it around couldn't do anything. And then we will be able to compress it, whereas moving it to one, then with some probability we won't be able to. And so using that, you can do a slightly more complex state preparation. By applying the fusion rules, you can look at charge measurements of different subsets. Okay, so like here, you have these three particles. Actually, maybe let's look at a qubit. So here you have these four particles. Okay, and let's call this 0, 1, the 0 state, and the 1, 1, the 1 state of this two-dimensional Hilbert space. So you see, if we take these 4, 1 particles and measure the charge of these first two, if it's 0, then we know we have the 0 state. Okay, so that lets us do a state preparation for the 0 state, because we make these 4 particles, we measure whether it's a 0 charge or not, and if it's 0, then we have 0 and we keep it, and if it's 1, then we throw it away and try again. Okay? Or maybe we have to do some, I don't know, this is various puzzles. You could do some braiding to make a different state and then project again in the zero state. Okay? So putting these things together, then you basically have the ability to measure in the 0-1 basis, you have the ability to produce states in 0-1 basis, and then we have these universal gates. So that's really all we need. Good question. Anything else? Okay, so then that will finish off what I'm going to say about topological quantum computing. There is various other anionic models known in the mathematical sense. Like I said, not a lot of these are known in physical systems, but there are people looking for them, working on them, and trying to create them in different ways. So what I thought I'd move on to next is something pretty much completely different, specifically operator quantum error correction. So this is, in some sense, a generalization of the error correcting codes we've talked about in the past. In some sense, it's not. I mean, it kind of falls into the definition of what I said before. You encode a state in a state of some small Hilbert space, k qubits, into a larger Hilbert space, n qubits. And then it has some errors, and you do an inverse operation to get the state back out again. But the difference here is that instead of encoding pure states of pure states, we encode pure states of subspaces. So how does that work? I need to erase some stuff. Let's see. Ah.
actually mean by mapping a pure state to a subspace?
Oh, well, we'll talk about that.
Isn't that sort of mixing apples and oranges?
Yeah. Okay, so let's consider something really stupid, which is suppose we have an NKD stabilizer code, okay, and we add one qubit in the state 0. Okay, well, so we have what the stabilizer does now. Well, we have the original stabilizer S, and then we've added this one qubit, which has stabilizer Z. Okay, and in particular, what we have now is a code that involves n plus one qubits, but clearly we haven't added any extra encoded qubits. So k is still k. I mean, the number of encoded qubits is still k. And what's the distance? Well, if there's an error on this qubit, it kind of doesn't, it clearly it's not having any effect on the other qubits. But of course, you could have all t errors on this first set of n. The distance hasn't increased either. It hasn't decreased, but it hasn't increased. The distance is d. We have an n plus 1 kd code, which is a degenerate code, by the way, because this last qubit has a stabilizer generator of weight 1. Right? So d is 2 or larger, then it's a degenerate code. Okay, so this is a really stupid way to make a bigger code. So why is it stupid? I mean, this extra qubit is not helping us in any way. It doesn't increase the distance. It doesn't help us even figure out what the errors are on the first qubits. Right? In fact, it wouldn't matter. If the extra generator is plus z or minus z, or for that matter, it could be plus x or minus x, or plus y or minus y, and it would be just the same, right? The code would have exactly the same properties. And in fact, when we correct errors, it's really kind of pointless. Why we can even bother to measure this last generator? It's not helping us at all. There's an error on that qubit, but we don't care. Right? So what? There's an error in that qubit. It takes us from plus z to minus z. So it's, you know, our code word with one state attached to it instead of a zero qubit. But it has no connection to the data at all. In fact, we don't care at all. About this extra qubit. So this is what I mean by encoding. This is what I mean by encoding a pure state as a subspace. We have a two-dimensional subspace of this last qubit. It could be anything, and we don't care. Okay. So the data is encoded as the error-correcting code on the first n qubits tensor some two-dimensional subspace on the last qubit, and any state in that subspace will work. If it changes, that's fine. It's not going to change our data. Okay? So that's it. That's operator quantum error correction. Up to unitaries, in fact, it really is operator quantum error correction. So instead of writing out that huge long name, call it OQECC. But we can, I mean, there is actually a point to this. It's not going to help us correct errors anymore, but it is actually useful for fault tolerance, it turns out, which is why I'm bothering to tell you that. So in general, let's see, as I said, the data is encoded as a subspace. In this case, and so this extra qubit is called a gauge qubit. And I guess this is by analogy to gauge theory. So we have some kind of symmetry, which seems like it's doing something interesting, but it's not really changing the state. So in this case, the symmetry, I guess, is operations on this last qubit. OK? So So hopefully you don't need to see the trivial code up there. But it's still worth thinking about, because we can use it to figure out what kinds of rules these things will satisfy. So this operator quantum error correction stuff was first derived in some general context of C-star algebras. But what I'm going to do, of course, is talk about the stabilizer version. So we're going to talk about stabilizer operator quantum error correction codes. And there it is. And so what we're going to imagine is we're going to imagine an example like that, where we've maybe more gauge qubits, more than one, and then we can use some Clipper group operation. Okay. So what does this mean? So we have a stabilizer S. Which in the trivial example is this, the original stabilizer, the stabilizer of the first n qubits. And then we have the Paulis on the gauge qubits. And I'll call those xi tilde, well, yi tilde, zi tilde. Okay, so in this case, that's x, y, and z on the last qubit, the nth qubit. And of course, there's going to be some ambiguity here, because if you multiply by an element of the stabilizer, well, that's doing nothing to the code words. So that's going to give you also kind of x on the last qubit, if you take x tilde times an element of the stabilizer. And then, of course, we also have, as before, we had the logical polys. Xi bar, Zi bar, et cetera. Okay. And those are doing the logical poly operations on the encoded qubits. Okay. So let's define the gauge group time the gauge group to be generated by these xi tildes, yi tildes, and zi tildes, and I guess also the stabilizer. Uh, called a gauge group T. Okay. And of course, I guess I didn't say this, but hopefully you can understand that when we look at the polys on the gauge qubits, I'm assuming that X, Y, and Z will anti-commute in pairs, because they're supposed to be like logical polys. And XI tilde will commute with XI prime tilde for I not equal to I prime, and with YI prime tilde and ZI prime tilde. Okay? The idea will be that, in general, we have the xi tildes, the yi tildes, and the zi tildes will have to be members of n of s, elements of n of s. So why is that? Well, if this wasn't true, then think back again to the trivial example. First of all, in the trivial example, clearly it is true, right? Errors on the last, or polys on the last qubit will commute with a stabilizer. So let's think about what if that wasn't true. Then that means that the syndrome of the stabilizer, so if you had something that didn't commute with a stabilizer, suppose xi tilde didn't commute with a stabilizer, something in the stabilizer. So that means if you do xi, the logical xi on the gauge qubit for the xi tilde, that will change the syndrome of the stabilizer code. But the problem is we need that syndrome to figure out what the errors are. And these xi tildes are just supposed to be trivial, non-unimportant things. Okay? So if that happens, then the syndrome will depend on what happens in the gauge qubits. But we wanted to define the gauge qubits by being things where it didn't matter what happened to them. Okay? So if this isn't true, errors on the gauge qubits will affect the symptoms. Which will mess up our error correction capability. And so what I said before about the xi tildes and the zi tildes anti-commuting, we can basically, what's going to happen is that G mod S is going to be isomorphic to P sub G. So we have G gauge qubits, little g gauge qubits. And so P sub G is the poly group on the gauge qubits. So in the trivial example up top, it's just the poly operations on the last n plus first qubit. Okay? Questions so far?
Gauge qubits have to be associated with real physical qubits, or is it just any operator?
Well, so in the general case, they're not going to be associated with kind of separate qubits. They're going to be encoded in some more complicated way. So what you can imagine, in fact, that the most general operator quantum correction code, well, up to questions of what errors it corrects, is going to be formed by something where you take a stabilizer code, you add some qubits, and then you do a perfect group operation. And so that might mix these up. Well, we'll see a specific example. Anything else? I know this is a big letdown over the heady abstraction of anions. Okay. Okay. So now, of course, we're interested in actually figuring out what errors we can correct using this. And of course, having the gauge qubits is going to present a complication. So let's think about, again, as usual, what errors we can detect first. Well, certainly, we can detect any error that's outside N of S, right? That will, as before, that will change the eigenvalues of the stabilizer. So measuring those eigenvalues gives us syncrome. We can see that it's non-trivial. And again, as before, anything that's in the stabilizer acts as the identity. But now we have this annoying set of new things inside N of S, the gauge qubits, the gauge operators. So what about xi tilde, yi tilde, and zi tilde? What about those? Can we detect those errors? Well, remember, we kind of define those things as being things that weren't going to change the value of the data. So when we've done this encoding, that means that anything in this gauge group, G, well, it might change the value to the gauge qubits. But it can't change the data. So therefore, the set of detectable errors is no longer N of S minus S, but N of S minus G. Understand that? So of course, the next question is correcting errors. So before, remember, we wanted to look at the product, EA dagger EV, and see if that was detectable. So is that still true? Is that still the right criterion? And it turns out it is. So why is that? So what's the interesting case? So if we have EA dagger EB that's outside N of S, then certainly they have different syncomes, so we can distinguish A and B, right? And if EA dagger EB is inside S, again, they do the same thing to the state. So those two conditions are the same. But the interesting case then is what happens if EA dagger EB is in G. Okay? So since G is a subset of N of S, we can't distinguish EA and EB by the syncrome. Because they have the same syncrome, right? That's what things in N of S, that's what when the product is in N of S, that's what it means. But does it matter? Okay, so what happens if we get to the wrong one? If EB occurs, but we do EA as our correction. Well, what's the overall operation? It's EA tagged for EB, which is in G. So that the overall operation only affects the gauge qubits. And therefore, to correct errors, so if we have a set of errors, as before, We can do that if and only if dA dagger dB is outside N of S minus G for all pairs. Okay? So, in one sense, we've enlarged the stabilizer by adding these gauge operators. So we haven't really enlarged it because we haven't increased N of S. Okay, so we have these two things, G and S. One of them is used to measure the syndromes, but the other replaces the stabilizer for kind of this degeneracy issue. And that thinks that whose product is within equal something in this gauge group act effectively the same way on the data. They only change the gauge group. Okay? Questions so far? Yeah?
How big can you make G relative to N of S?
So what's going to happen is that the larger you make G, the fewer encoded qubits you have. So I guess I haven't really calculated that, but why don't we do that before I get to the example? So if we have n qubits and r generators of S, so then we have k encoded qubits, right, which are represented by these logical polys. So the logical polys thing is that those are also in N of S. So as you make the gauge group larger, you're squeezing out these logical polys. So you have fewer encoded qubits. And in particular, we have that n is equal to r plus g plus k, which again, you can just think by looking at the trivial example, right? If you add more gauge qubits and more total qubits, it balances. But if you add more gauge qubits without adding more total qubits, they have to either come out of the stabilizer, in which case you have fewer things to detect the syndrome, or come out of the encoded qubits. So that's what prevents you from making the whole, all of N of S and then being able to correct it. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at a specific example. So let's, in fact, think of the non-qubit short code that we talked about at the very beginning. So instead of the original way of writing it down, we think of these qubits on a 3x3 lattice. Non-qubits. So what is the stabilizer? So remember, we had these sets of three, right? So we had the X-type generators and V-type generators. So we had two generators that were composed of tensor products of X's, which we're going to take to be two rows. Okay, so we're going to have x, 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 and get into on these x's. So for instance, we can take the top two rows and the bottom two rows. Okay? And then we also had Z generators, which were, there were six of them. So each of them had two Zs, and those were paired within a row. So we had ZZ and ZZ, 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 ZZ. Okay? But looking at this, it's kind of asymmetric between the Xs and the Zs. So this operator quantum-error correct inversion of this code is going to be restore the symmetry between X and Z. So this is going to be what's called the Bacon short code, because it was, well, so there are, it's building on the 9-qubit short code, and this particular version was came up with by Dave Bacon. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take these 9 qubits. And the x's are again going to be, so the stabilizer is again going to be, so there's two generators. The two generators each have 6 x's in 2 rows. And then for symmetry, we're going to take 2 generators of 6 z's in 2 columns. So we're going to go like this. So for instance, these two, and then this and this. OK? Everyone understand that stabilizer? But of course, this is, well, so OK, so it's a distance 2 code as it's written now, right? Because, well, there, for every qubit, you have an x and a z in some generator. Oh, by the way, these commute, right? You can see that because, well, like these two and these two will intersect on these 4 qubits. So every qubit has both an x and a z, so it's distance at least 2. But you can easily see that there's lots of wave 2 things that will commute with this, right? Like z, z. This commutes with the x generator that involves this first row. And of course, it commutes with the z generators. What we're going to do is we're going to throw in a bunch of things like that to act as gauge qubits. We're going to draw them out, so basically pull them out of N of S, so they're not going to count as errors anymore. Oh, yes, 2 more colors. OK, so what we're going to do is we're going to take pairs like this. And these are going to become gauge, the z tilde operators. In the gauge group. And pairs like this XX pairs in columns. These will become the x tilde operators.
So are you saying here, in some sense, that so 2 qubits would actually be equivalent to 1 gauge qubit?
No.
No?
Because, see, the problem is that so you have a ZZ here and an XX here. Those two anti-commute, so those are like the x tilde, z tilde pair. But they're actually involved in 3 qubits. It's just that one of them is on 2, mm-hmm. and the other is on a different thing. So let's see. So think about it. These are, in fact, all in NFS because, well, maybe too many colors here, but so remember that the yellow vertical ones form the stabilizer when you take two of them. And so XX in a column, that's okay because the columns are kept together in the Z generators. And similarly for the rows, the pairs in the rows are Z's, and the rows form the X generators. Okay. So these are, in fact, in NFS, and it turns out that these are all the way two things in NFS. In fact, it's pretty easy to see that if you really think about it, right? Because all you can do is you can throw away these XX pairs, and these ZZ pairs then become the rest of the stabilizer for the Schwarz code. So we know that any weight 2z thing that commutes with these x's has to be in this set here. And just by symmetry, the same thing has to be true for the x's. So let's count how many of these things there are. Well, the way I drew it, you'd think there are 6 of these zz pairs. A sensible thing to think. But actually, there's only 4. Because what happens if you multiply them together? Let's see. So if you multiply this one, and this one, you get z's in these two columns, which is already generated as a stabilizer. So this third one down here is kind of redundant. And similarly, this one, this one, this one, the third one down here is redundant by the same way. You multiply them together, you get the two columns here. So we have 4 independent things here. And here also 4 independent ones. So this tells us we have 4 generators of the stabilizer and 4 gauge qubits. Right, each gauge qubit gets an x tilde and a z tilde. And we have 9 total qubits, so therefore we have 1 logical qubit. And we can figure out what the x bar and z bar are. Well, the x bar is going to be just the x's in a single row. Because that's what commutes with a z that has 2 columns here. A single row is going to intersect with 2 columns in 2 places. And it could be any row. Why is that? Well, the stabilizer is the product of x's in 2 rows. So if we take the first row and multiply that stabilizer again, we'll get a second row. And similarly, we could get to the third row. And similarly, the z bar is the z's in a single column. End with an ice cream wrapper. Okay, questions so far? No? Okay. So I guess I kind of said why this corrects one error. So this has distance 3. Distance is defined basically the same way as before. But based on this criterion, we see we could define it as the smallest weight thing in N of S minus G. I have a new blackboard, but I'm not sure I really need it. So why am I interested in this thing in the first place? It's because it's good for fault tolerance. And so why is that? Well, the thing is that each of these 4 stabilizer generators, while it's on 6 qubits, can actually be written as a product of this 2-qubit gauge generators. Right? For instance, we have gauge generators, ZZ pairs, and rows. So this, this, and this, we multiply them together. As I said, we get these 2 columns. And similarly for all the others. And so the upside of that is, well, it's a lot easier to measure a 2-qubit operation than a 6-qubit operation. Particularly when you want to do fault tolerance, and you say, well, you have to build a cat state, and then you have to test the cat state. Well, 2-qubit things you don't have to test, right? Because if it's a 2-qubit EPR pair, an error on one of them is the same as the error on the other. And in particular, there's no such thing really as an error on both of them, because you can get an arbitrary state by just doing an error on one of them. An error on the second one can be then mapped onto the first one. In particular, if we measure not the stabilizer generators, but these gauge operators, well, that kind of is a bad thing to do. The gauge operators don't commute with each other. But who cares? Because then measuring one of the x tildes followed by one of the z tildes, so what? It'll mess up a gauge qubit. We don't care about that. And based on these things, then we can deduce the synchro, the eigenvalue of the stabilizer. And so that tells us how to correct errors. And we can do that again by only looking at 2-qubit things. And so that's a lot better for fault tolerance. So the upshot is that if we use not actually this 9-qubit version, but the 25-qubit, if you have a 5-by-5 thing instead of 3-by-3, that gives a threshold of around 2 × 10⁻⁴. Sorry, −4, which is almost an order of magnitude higher than what we got using the concatenated 7-qubit code. So this is a good thing to do. So you can go even higher than this using kind of more elaborate ancilla factory things, but those have a much higher overhead. So this the other nice thing about this is, you know, lays out nicely in 2 dimensions. So you can imagine that there wouldn't really be much of a hit, if any at all, for doing nearest neighbor gates with this 9-qubit or 25-qubit Forbes anchor. But I don't think anyone has carried all the way through to figure out the actual threshold there. Yeah?
This is still the gauge qubits are still doing nearest neighbor 2-bit.
In the 3-25. Yeah, that's right. So it's the kind of the most mindless generalization. Again, the generators are columns and rows, x's in rows and z's in columns, and the gauge qubits are adjacent pairs. Same to, I mean, you can generalize to n by n. Even shrinking to 2 by 2, and then you get a distance 2 by 2. Anything else?
Do we lose anything doing this?
Losing anything over the 9-qubit code?
Yeah.
Well, we did a little bit. So the 9-qubit code, we could correct one bit flip error in each set of 3. So one bit flip error, in this case, in each row. We can't do that anymore.
Now you can just correct one overall.
Yes. I mean, so there are some combinations of bit flip errors that you can correct. For instance, if they're in the gauge group. So you gained a little bit there. You have combinations of bit flip errors that you don't even have to correct anymore. But overall, there's a loss in terms of which combinations you can correct and which ones you can't. So we did lose a little bit. But we're gaining something, too. So for fault tolerance, it turns out to be worthwhile.
And that's where the symmetry came back, because we're going to only do one pay there?
That's right. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so we've degraded the bit flip capability to the same level as the phase bit flip. OK. So any further questions on this? so then I should first say a few things about next week. So again, as I hope all of you remember, you'll have to present your, at least the ones taken for credit, you'll have to present your projects next Tuesday, same time, same place. My plan is not to record that class. So while you'll be presenting in front of me and in front of your classmates, you don't have to worry about presenting in front of the whole world. I do invite people who've been auditing the class to come see these presentations. And I hope that you'll make them to be understandable, not just by me, but by the other people taking the class. Let's see, was there anything else I wanted to say about that? Yeah, so let's say the written versions of these projects will be due the week after that, on the 10th of April. I encourage you not to put that off, because you will be graded on your presentation as well as on the written part. So you really want to have at least conceptually understood everything, figured out how to present it by next week. But you know, you can handle the proofreading the following days. And maybe something will come up during the talk, a question or something that will help you understand it better. Anything else? Yeah?
Did you publish a list of what the topics are going to be?
That's a good idea. There's a mild difficulty is that some people haven't completely narrowed down their topic. but I'll try to do that once. I'll try to get people to narrow down very quickly, because you know it's really not much time left. And then do that. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you explain more like blackboard style presentation?
Oh yes. Okay, good. So that's also what I want to say. So that's up to you. You can do it on the blackboard. You can do it with a document camera, which takes transparencies or just pieces of paper. Or you can hook up your computer. I mean, we have full facilities here. If you want something more elaborate than that. If you want sound hooked up to your computer, you can probably arrange that too, but have to talk to Giga.
Error corrections.
It's a small enough room that we can maybe even hear your speakers from your computer record.
And so it's what, like half an hour, 40 minutes?
So with eight people, I guess 20 minutes is the expectation. So it should take, so if you multiply 8 by 20, you get slightly less than 180, but these things always run a little over. So the last order of business, class evaluations, so you get to grade me, which is too late for you, but will benefit the next victims of this class. My idea here, again, you don't have to be taking for credit to fill this out. The idea here is fill out as many questions as you want, turn it in to my mailbox downstairs, which says Daniel. It's behind reception at Perimeter. So you can do that today, later in the week, or next week when you come back for the presentation. Okay? Here, I'll leave them here for people to take and do whatever you want with.